At the sound of his voice, the director started into a guilty realization of where he was, shot a glance at Bernard, and averted his eyes, blushed darkly, looked at him again with sudden suspicion, and angrily, on his dignity, "Don't imagine," he said, "that I'd had any indecorous relation with the girl. Nothing emotional, nothing long-drawn. It was all perfectly healthy and normal." He handed Bernard the permit. "I really don't know why I bored you with this trivial anecdote." Furious with himself for having given away a discreditable secret, he vented his rage on Bernard. The look in his eyes was now frankly malignant. "And I should like to take this opportunity, Mr. Marx," he went on, "of saying that I'm not at all pleased with the reports I receive of your behaviour outside working hours. You may say that this is not my business, but it is. I have the good name of the centre to think of. My workers must be above suspicion, particularly those of the highest castes. Alphas are so conditioned that they do not have to be infantile in their emotional behaviour, but that is all the more reason for their making a special effort to conform. It is their duty to be infantile, even against their inclination. And so, Mr. Marx, I give you fair warning." The director's voice vibrated with an indignation that had now become wholly righteous and impersonal, was the expression of the disapproval of society itself. "If ever I hear again of any lapse from a proper standard of infantile decorum, I shall ask for your transference to a sub-centre, preferably to Iceland. Good morning." And swivelling round in his chair, he picked up his pen and began to write. "That'll teach him," he said to himself. But he was mistaken, for Bernard left the room with a swagger, exulting as he banged the door behind him in the thought that he stood alone, embattled against the order of things, elated by the intoxicating consciousness of his individual significance and importance. Even the thought of persecution left him undismayed, was rather tonic than depressing. He felt strong enough to meet and overcome affliction, strong enough to face even Iceland. And this confidence was the greater for his not for a moment really believing that he would be called upon to face anything at all. People simply weren't transferred for things like that. Iceland was just a threat, a most stimulating and life-giving threat. Walking along the corridor, he actually whistled. Heroic was the account he gave that evening of his interview with the DHC. "Whereupon," it concluded, "I simply told him to go to the bottomless past and marched out of the room, and that was that." He looked at Helmholtz Watson expectantly, awaiting his due reward of sympathy, encouragement, admiration. But no word came. Helmholtz sat silent, staring at the floor. He liked Bernard. He was grateful to him for being the only man of his acquaintance with whom he could talk about the subjects he felt to be important. Nevertheless, there were things in Bernard which he hated. This boasting, for example, and the outbursts of an abject self-pity with which it alternated, and his deplorable habit of being bold after the event, and full, in absence, of the most extraordinary presence of mind. He hated these things just because he liked Bernard. The seconds passed. Helmholtz continued to stare at the floor. And suddenly Bernard blushed and turned away.